Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 1:34 p.m. We're in Belts, Room 105 at the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, February 16th, 2026. Happy President's Day and Elizabeth Peratrovich Day to everyone. Members present today are Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Merrick is excused and away at finance. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off our silencer cell phones and join me in extending a warm Senate Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Chloe Miller. We have two items on our agenda today. First, Senate Bill 16, Refuse Utility Regulations, and Senate Bill 217, Employer Contributions. First up, Senate Bill 16. With us to present the bill, we have the Honorable Senator Rob Myers and his staff, Dawson Mann. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us in Senate Labor and Commerce today. Please state your names for the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, I am Robert Myers, Senator for District Q up in the North Pole and eastern part of the Fairbanks Borough. Joining me today is my Chief of Staff, Dawson Mann. Today we're going to be presenting SB 16, Refuse Utility Regulations. Before Mr. Mann provides the sectional analysis for the bill, very short, I just want to speak to the sponsor statement shortly. We also do have a couple of invited testimony with us. So the problem that we're trying to solve with SB 16 is balancing protection for the consumer with timely processing of the rate cases by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. By statute, the RCA has 450 days to hear a rate case. But then they also have the option of another 450-day extension. From what we're hearing from the refuse utilities, the RCA is using that extension most of the time. So a rate case filing is taking nearly 3 years. What that means is instead of asking for a bump of, say, a few percentage points on their prices, the utilities are having to ask for price bumps of 20% or more, followed by an immediate filing of the very next rate case the very following year. This creates some sticker shock for customers at a time when some utilities are attempting to expand their business outside of the traditional city boundaries, picking up one or two customers on a street at a time. That is completely impossible when rate cases take so long and create such huge price changes. SB 16 is based off of language that passed this body unanimously 4 years ago in another slightly larger bill. It also passed the other body 2 years ago, but it has never passed both bodies in the same bill in the same year, unfortunately. Senate Bill 16 is designed to streamline the rate adjustment process for refuse utilities by allowing them to make use of the already existing simplified rate filing procedure. This procedure allows utilities to apply for rate adjustments over a specified period, provided they meet certain regulatory requirements. The RCA will be required to adopt specific regulations tailored to the unique nature of refuse utilities. These regulations will include provisions for sufficient public notice and meaningful opportunities for ratepayers to comment on the rate filings. I will note that one change from older versions of this language is that we made the wording regarding the public process statute and not just intent language, as it had been in the initial version from a few years ago. By doing so, the bill promotes transparency and accountability in the rate-setting process, safeguarding the interests of both consumers and utility providers. SB 16 establishes a balanced approach to regulating refuse utility rates in Alaska, prioritizing fairness, transparency, public participation, and expediency. And that, with that, Mr. Chair, if you're ready, Mr. Mann can go over the sectional.
Thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. Mr. Mann.
Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman, members of the committee. For the record, Dawson Mann, staff to Senator Myers. I will now touch on the brief sectional analysis for SB 16. Section 1, page 1, lines 4 through 14, and page 2, lines 1 through 4. This section amends AS 4205381E to include refuse utilities. And I will clarify that refuse utilities currently regulated by the RCA and does not add any other refuse utilities that are not currently regulated by the RCA. This section is the section of statutes that provides for the simplified rate filing procedure. This section also outlines that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska shall adopt regulations specific to refuse utilities and provide for sufficient public notice and time for ratepayers to meaningfully comment on the rate filings. And as Senator Myers said, this language was at one point intent language in a previous version of the bill from 2022. In this version of the bill and in the version of the bill from 2024, we made that strict statutes after conversations with the drafter. And then section 2, page 2, line 5 establishes an immediate effective date.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Excellent. We will go now to your invited testifiers. First up is Ms. Julie Vogler. Ms. Vogler, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
For the record, Julie Vogler, through the chair, Chair Bjorkman, my understanding is that the RCA is here available to answer any questions on behalf of the committee has for us.
Oh, most excellent. My apologies, ma'am. Next up, we have Kurt Froning. Mr. Froning, could you please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony, please?
Yeah, good afternoon, Chairman Bjorkman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Froning, and I'm here on behalf of Waste Connections of Alaska, more commonly known as Alaska Waste. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to share our concerns with the current revenue requirement study process at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska as it applies to solid waste utilities, and to express our support for efforts to simplify and streamline that process while still preserving transparency and regulatory oversight. I have a few minutes of prepared testimony that I'd be happy to share, or if you prefer, I can jump straight to answering any questions you might have.
If you could provide your testimony, that would be most excellent.
Okay, thank you very much. As was stated earlier, under current statute, the RCA is allowed up to 450 days to review a revenue requirement filing, and the law allows for extensions beyond that timeline. In practice, what this means is that our rate cases stretch on for well over a year under the best of circumstances. These proceedings are extremely complex and resource intensive. They require a significant amount of internal staff time and additionally result in hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal and consulting fees. While these costs are technically recoverable through the rates, the reality is that Alaska customers ultimately end up paying for them. This process is especially challenging for small and rural solid waste providers. While I don't claim to speak on behalf of anyone else in the industry, we do have anecdotal evidence and conversations about people who other companies that struggle with this process. Many simply do not have the staffing or the financial capacity to navigate a lengthy, highly technical regulatory proceeding. That raises real concerns about financial sustainability, service continuity, and the long-term viability of essential solid waste services that protect our public health. To put Alaska's process in context, I'd like to briefly highlight how Washington State handles solid waste rate regulation through its Utilities and Transportation Commission, or the UTC. Washington routinely processes solid waste rate filings in a fraction of the time it takes in Alaska. Some filings are completed with little to no outside legal or consulting expense and are done in as short as 45 days. Their success is built on three core principles. First, simplified rate processes. Washington uses standardized filings that are scaled to the size and complexity of the utility. Second, collaborative staff engagement. The UTC staff works proactively with utilities, often before a filing is even submitted, to ensure the data is clear and complete. And third, they have clear and informal communication channels. Issues are resolved quickly through discussions rather than a prolonged discovery period. The result is a process that is faster, less expensive, yet still protective of the customers. We believe Alaska can adopt a similar approach, tailored to our unique regulatory environment. That is why Alaska Waste supports SB 16 and the opportunity it provides to work collaboratively with the legislature, the RCA, and other stakeholders. Specifically, we believe progress can be made in three areas. First, expanded use of simplified rate filings under current statutes for other utilities. Solid waste utilities should be allowed to file simplified cases when appropriate, with clear thresholds and guardrails that protect customers while avoiding unnecessary complexity. Second, pre-filing education and training. Solid waste operations are very different from other utility sectors. Providing industry-specific education to RCA audit staff before filings occur would significantly streamline the review process. And thirdly, improve communication during the review. The current discovery process is overly formal and slow, allowing more informal, real-time communication between RCA staff and utilities would prevent misunderstandings and resolve issues more efficiently. In closing, we believe that simplifying the revenue requirement study process and adopting proven best practices from states like Washington will, first of all, lower costs for Alaska customers, secondly, reduce barriers for small and rural providers, and lastly, promote greater stability across the solid waste industry. Alaska Waste is committed to being a constructive partner in this effort, and we welcome the opportunity to participate in working groups or further discussions to develop specific solutions. Thank you for your time, your attention, and your service to the state of Alaska. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Froning. Any questions or comments from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, brings the bill back before the committee and to Senator Myers. Senator Myers, do you have any closing comments before we set the aside today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just appreciate the committee's time today. We're just trying to make things a little simpler so that the refuse utilities can expand a little bit easier and more customers can take advantage of their services while at the same time still protecting customers and not giving them some serious rate hikes.
Perfect. Makes sense to me. Well, thank you very much. We'll be taking this bill up again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we will set Senate Bill 16 aside for further consideration at a future hearing. Take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record now. It's 1:48 p.m. here in Belt's room 105. Next up is Senate Bill 217. With us today from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, we have Commissioner Kathy Munoz, and some of her staff will be joining her as well. Commissioner, thank welcome you. To Senate Labor and Commerce. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee. It's nice to be here. For the record, my name is Kathy Munoz. I am the commissioner for the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And with me in the audience is Kim Kolvig. She is the legislative liaison. Also with us is Paloma Harbor, the director of the Division of Employment and Training Services. And finally, Dirk Kraft, director of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. And after I make introductory remarks, directors Harbor and Kraft will come forward for the balance of the presentation.
Excellent.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So in October of 2023, the Alaska Workforce Investment Board convened industry leaders and educators from around the state to develop common goals around workforce development. The convening demonstrated a shared commitment to build strategies to retain young and working age Alaskans, to provide them with essential skills, and to create an employment climate for the workforce of tomorrow. Following the convening, hundreds of surveys, forums, and interviews were conducted, continuing to refine stakeholder input around common workforce goals. This led to the adoption of Alaska's Workforce Future, a plan pictured here in this slide, Mr. Chairman. Shared goals include enhanced career awareness and pathways, development of a skilled and qualified workforce, retain Alaskans and attract new Alaskans, foster regional workforce development, improve infrastructure and access to support services, and ensure sustainability and continuity of workforce development efforts. Mr. Chairman, SB 217 before you supports each of these goals. Going into 2026, the research and analysis section of the Alaska Department of Labor projects Alaska employment at 340,800 jobs around the state. This does not include sole proprietors and small business owners, so that number is actually larger. This is the largest projected number in our state's history. Some of the highest growth areas are in construction, in mining, oil and gas, and also in healthcare. This activity represents tremendous opportunity for Alaskans, but we need to be ready, we need a skilled workforce, and we need to have the funding supports in place to ensure that Alaskans are the beneficiaries of these opportunities. Senate Bill 217 makes a significant investment in Alaskan workers by using excess employment security tax revenue. Currently, the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund exceeds statutory solvency targets. The state of Alaska, in other words, is collecting more tax revenue than is needed to fund unemployment insurance benefits in a worst-case scenario. And as an example, during the pandemic, the Unemployment Trust Fund dropped to about $230 million, even when tens of thousands of Alaskans were drawing benefits. The current balance of the fund is about $830 million, and our target solvency balance is about $550 million. SB 217 would lower current taxes on employers. It would remove the minimum 1% tax in rate classes 1 through 20, and in its place, we would institute a 0.4% tax that would generate approximately $45 million per year for workforce development through the state training and employment program. Once the UI Trust Fund reaches a target balance of approximately $550 million, the 0.4% would flow back into the UI Trust Fund for the payment of unemployment insurance benefits. This mechanism ensures the long-term health of the fund while also addressing the current workforce challenges and demand. The revenues generated through SB 217 would be made available through competitive grants to Alaska's regional training providers, augmenting the current STEP program. In FY26, 37 training programs, union and non-union, private and public, received STEP grant funding. However, many more excellent training programs were not funded due to limited resources. SB 217 revenue would also be used to support individual trainings and supportive services needed during training, such as books, equipment, travel to and from training, and child care. These individual training grants would be distributed through Alaska's 14 job centers. As we prepare for a natural gas pipeline and large developments around the state, including the Nome Port Project, the Pika and Willow projects on the North Slope, rural and urban healthcare expansion, mine and transportation developments, we need Alaskans to be the beneficiaries of these opportunities. What we do now can make a huge difference in Alaskans taking advantage of these opportunities. SB 217 makes a significant investment in Alaskans while lowering taxes on Alaskan employers. It ensures sustainability and continuity of workforce development efforts in a vital partnership with Alaska's regional training providers. It supports all of the shared goals of Alaska's industry and training leaders, which were articulated in Alaska's Workforce Future Blueprint Plan. Mr. Chairman, we appreciate your consideration. We thank you for your time today. I'd like to invite up to the table Directors Paloma Harbor of the Division of Employment and Training Services to discuss the mechanics of the UI Trust Fund, and also Director Dirk Kraft to talk about the STEP process and how the Alaska Workforce Investment Committee works to ensure that funding is distributed fairly across the state. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues, and I will be available for questions after they're done. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dirk Kraft. I serve as Executive Director of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. And on behalf of the board, I want to thank you for your consideration of SB 217 and your ongoing commitment to Alaska's workforce. For the board, or for the committee's awareness, AWIB, we serve as the lead planning and coordinating entity for Alaska's public workforce and development system. We're a federally designated board consisting of 32 members. That includes seats with business, industry, private sector, vocational education, secondary education, organized labor, and other seats. And we provide policy oversight of state and federally funded job training and vocational education programs, such as STEP. There are approximately 580 workforce investment boards around the country. Alaska has one state workforce investment board that serves as both the umbrella statewide board and the local board. We do this because it allows us better statewide coordination of all of our training programs, as well as administrative efficiencies. STEP's purpose, the program's purpose, is to enhance quality and accessibility of in-state training for Alaska residents to meet workforce needs of employers in Alaska. It additionally seeks to increase resident hire in industries with historically high non-resident hire rates. It was originally established in 1989 as a pilot program, and it was later made permanent by the legislature due to its success. It is specifically designed to reduce future UI claims by helping Alaskans who have paid into the system gain skills for in-demand occupations through upskilling, reskilling, and obtaining industry-recognized credential attainment, thus increasing their employability and reducing the likelihood of future draws against the UI Trust. And with strong legislative support from over the years, STEP has been the strongest and most stable training program, with approximately over 82% of its participants receiving employment post-exit every year. And this is just some examples of our current grantees. And here's a map of just showing some of the regional STEP grantees we have. So our board works closely with our research and analysis division to follow the latest labor trends and projections and industry workforce demands to establish industry priorities that we use to determine grantees each year. So we operate through a publicly posted competitive RGA That's request for grant applications around mid-February through the end of March. Sometimes we push that out a little bit later. And board members evaluate and score all those applications using established criteria aligned with those industry training priorities and regional demand. The applications are then ranked and awards are made within the available funding that we're given each year. And structured fiscal and performance safeguards are applied through our grant agreements to make sure they're meeting those performance requirements we have. Over the last several years, the board's seen the cost of administering this training and the grants increase dramatically through travel, lodging, supplies, staffing, and particularly in remote and some rural areas of the state. And it's required far greater investment than when the program was first established. This has limited a lot of our training providers' ability to meet the rising demand and the inflationary pressures, and increasing funds available for our grants will help offset those costs and ensure continued delivery of high-quality, accessible training programs around the state. In addition to competitive grants through STEP, the Division of Employment and Training Services delivers vocational job training services through its job center network, like the commissioner mentioned, through the individual training accounts. Demand for those services has also received, or it's been at a record high the last several years that Director Harbor can speak a little bit more about. And increasing that funding will also allow their system to expand capacity and meet those needs around the 14 job centers around the state. And with that, I will pass it over to Director Harbor.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Paloma Harbor, Director for the Division of Employment and Training Services within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I'm over the 14 job centers and the unemployment insurance program. I'm primarily going to speak to the unemployment insurance impacts of this legislation, as well as the tax revenue and the flows of that. But I'm happy to answer questions on the individual training accounts spoken to previously as well. This slide shows the balance of the unemployment or UI trust, unemployment insurance or UI trust fund since January of 2019. With the high of $506 million in November of 2019, just before the COVID pandemic. As Commissioner mentioned, due to the pandemic, the trust fund did drop significantly, down to $267.3 million. But even with that significant draw on resources, it was healthy. It remained healthy and fully recovered by October of 2022 to $517.9 million. As of November of 2025, the UI Trust Fund balance was $821 million, which exceeded the statutory solvency targets of 3 to 3.3% of wages by $247 million. This overcapitalization of the UI Trust Fund is primarily due to the employer statutory UI tax minimum of 1%, which is preventing tax rates from coming down to the level that the current balance and economic conditions would otherwise require. Assuming no change to economic trends impacting wages or benefit costs, the UI Trust Fund could go without either employer or employee contributions through 2040 and still exceed the statutory solvency targets by more than one percentage point. This chart on this slide here shows the current flow of employer and employee contributions to UI, STEP, and the Technical and Vocational Education Program, or TVEP. Employees currently pay 0.1% tax to STEP, 0.1% of wages, to STEP, a 0.25% tax to TVEP, and there is a statutory minimum tax of 0.5% to UI, but that is reduced by their STEP and TVEP contributions, resulting in a net 0.15% tax to UI. Based on taxable wages paid in state fiscal year 2025, this equated to $10.8 million in revenue to STEP, $27.1 million in revenue to TVEP, and about $125 million in revenue to the UI Trust Fund. I didn't have it on the chart, but it might be worth noting that benefit costs were around $40 million, $125 million in revenue to the fund, and only $40 million in costs. Currently, all employers, except for those in the penalty rate class, are paying the statutory minimum tax rate of 1%. All right. This chart shows the proposed flow of employer and employee contributions to UI STEP and TVEP under Senate Bill 217. The UI taxes for employers with more than 1 year of experience would be able to go to zero, as long as UI trust fund solvency warrants it. Employers would pay a new STEP tax of 0.4% until such time as they had to start contributing to UI again. Then the STEP contributions would go down by the amount that they were contributing to UI until it reached zero. In calendar year 2027 alone, this would mean an overall savings to employers of $68 million. This legislation will also expand the state's capacity to develop an Alaskan workforce by putting five times more revenue into the STEP account, which is critical to meeting the demand for a trained Alaskan workforce. And this slide provides projections through 2040, calendar year 2040, of what the various revenues would be under Senate Bill 217. You can see STEP revenue would go up from currently $11.5 million to almost $55.8 million. And UI revenue would come down to just $22.2 million, which would then start drawing down the excess balance in the trust fund. But even with this draw and less revenue coming into the fund, 2040, we're just now starting to get to the target solvency reserve ratio of 3.3%, at which point employers would then have to start contributing to the UI taxes again, and they would contribute less to the STEP tax. And that concludes our presentation for the day. Any questions from the committee?
Thank you very much, Ms. Harbor and Mr. Kraft. We're glad that you're here today. Are there any committee questions? Senator Yunt.
Through the chair, great presentation so far. A couple quick questions, kind of a two-part one. One is the fund that the money goes into, is it interest-bearing? And if so, and it is interest-bearing, does the interest stay in those accounts at the end of the year, or does it get swept into the general fund?
Through the chair, Senator Yunt, it is a part of the Jafonzi group, the Department of Revenue. So the STEP program, specifically the training program, is a part of the Jafonzi group, and the interest goes to the general fund.
Okay. And how about the UI Trust?
The UI Trust receives its own interest. It is not a part of the Jafonzi group.
Okay. And that's baked into your formula on how long you think this will, you know, be solvent and do fine without contributions?
That is correct. In fiscal year 2025, the interest to the UI Trust Fund was about $22 million.
And what's the rate of return, or what are you using for your?
Through the chair, Senator Yunt, we don't manage the UI Trust Fund. The federal government does, U.S. Treasury. I don't have a lot of information on that.
All right. Thank you.
Any further questions? I have a couple. I'll just make an observation, then I have a couple of questions. There are multiple bills kind of floating around the building. I think probably enough to spend down this balance in the UI Trust Fund four or five times. However, I'm wondering about the trajectory of the fund before 2019. So how did we get here before the COVID era? I would guess we have a lot of deposits, but not a lot of debits. Had that been a trend before 19? What did this fund look like before that time?
Chair Bjorkman, yes, at the time, prior to COVID, we were seeing record level of wages and employment. As Commissioner mentioned, we're after COVID. We've seen it since. We are also seeing historic lows in unemployment insurance claims. So the actual demand for benefits is significantly lower than has been experienced historically.
Very good.
I've heard many people say that unemployment benefits should be increased. Why might people hold that opinion? Sure. How have those benefit levels changed over time?
Chair Bjorkman, the last time the unemployment insurance benefits were adjusted was in calendar year 2009. And that at that time, the maximum unemployment insurance benefit was set at $370 a week, which was roughly about 50% wage replacement at the time. That's my understanding. I was not here. And it is federal kind of benchmark or guide to want to replace about 50% of wages with unemployment. And obviously, wages, as we mentioned, have increased significantly over this time frame, and benefits have not. The department did analyze what the benefit would be if inflated with wages up to the taxable wage base, and it would be $440 a week. So an increase from $370. And then we also did an analysis of what the benefit would be if it had been adjusted with inflation, which is not the same thing as the taxable wage base. And that would have been $525 a week.
Interesting. So that's a significant amount of money in the course of a month.
Mm-hmm.
What do you attribute that difference to, the difference between inflation adjusted and then moving with the wage base?
Chair Bjorkman, I'm not an expert on the economic stuff, but I will say that there's a lot of things that go into CPI, housing, groceries. We've seen, especially since COVID, the cost of most goods is up significantly. Wages don't move the same speed as other costs. So a lot of the salary increases and things kind of follow. CPI happens, and then you get your bargaining unit increases or your other things. And so you'll see wages tend to lag actual cost increases.
Understood. So I think quick math there, the difference, if the weekly difference is $85, it's like $340, I guess, over the course of a month. The reason why I ask is many people are talking about increasing that benefit. Mm-hmm. How would that impact this model?
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman, for the question. We did run an analysis of this bill with both the $440 benefit and the $525, and we assumed that if the benefit was increased, it would also then be inflated by wages or CPI accordingly. Under the $470. I apologize for that.
Okay.
$470. Under that model, 2030, employers would start to recontribute to UI tax. And the trust fund would reach the target solvency level at 2034 versus 2040 that we mentioned previously. Under the $525 maximum weekly benefit, it's actually the same years, 2030 and 2033 is when we would hit target solvency.
Okay.
Under current economic conditions. I do want to make sure to add that.
Gotcha. No, that's always the big variable. Also, I thought I heard you talk about the step tax going to zero at some point in this plan. Can you tell us more about that? Like, what would happen to step if it went to zero?
Chair Bjorkman, I should clarify, the employer contribution to step could go back to zero if the trust fund required the full 0.4% tax from employers for the UI trust fund solvency. So something like that more than likely would be a downturn in the economy, or if benefit demand significantly increased, then the employer tax rate would go back up and their step contribution would go down, again, dollar for dollar. So the employee contribution would still continue to go to step, but you wouldn't have as much total revenue in the account.
Understood. Okay. And is there a specific policy choice or some kind of guiding principle as to why that cost wouldn't be shared between an employee and an employer?
Sorry, Chair, can you clarify for me which cost?
So why would it be? I would assume that as an employer, like I have a vested interest in there being employees that are trained to do the jobs that I want them. Mm-hmm. Also, employees would have a vested interest in having the skills, tools, and abilities needed to do the job. So why is the cost just on the employer to pay for this program that is a grant funding to sometimes like for-profit businesses?
Chair Bjorkman, so currently employees already contribute to this program, 0.1% of taxes. And they contribute to the UI. So total UI tax minimum for employees is 0.5%. They currently give 0.25% to TVEP and 0.1% to STEP. The remaining 0.15 is the only portion that is still going to the trust fund. There is another piece of legislation that this committee has heard, Senate Bill 159, that would divert another 0.1%. from UI to STEP. So this bill does not conflict with that one. It still leaves that one able to move, you know, at the same time if wanted, if needed, to fund STEP that much. But I would say STEP is already, employers and employees are already contributing, and so little of the employee contribution is still going to the UI tax that it really doesn't move the needle as much as the employer contribution.
Understood. Yeah, I follow that. That makes good sense. My question was just around the step tax and why that amount of money would just be placed on the employee and not shared with the employer. But maybe I'm not understanding all of it.
Mr. Chair, Dirk Kraft, Alaska Workforce Investment Board. I believe, just to further clarify, help answer that question, I believe we're still only one of three states that has an employee contribution to the UI fund.
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
So we're in the extreme minority for states that even require employees to make a contribution to the UI fund. And again, that was established in 1989, and part of that was to divert some of that to these training funds. So we're just in one of a few states that even have an employee contribution.
And I guess, Chair Bjorkman, just to make sure I'm understanding or trying to clarify, what's currently happening is employees are the only ones contributing to training. They're the only ones. And this bill would have employers start contributing to training as well. But when unemployment insurance, because that's a area of sensitivity, is that the unemployment trust fund, we don't want it to get unstable because that negatively impacts both employers and employees, right? When you have an unstable UI trust fund, that's why the legislation is written such that employer contributions will go back to the trust fund if needed.
Okay. Very good. Any further questions? Okay. Well, thank you all very much. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
This time we'll set Senate Bill 217 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday of this week. That will be the 18th of this month, when we will hear Senate Bill 150, Net Metering Program and Fund, as well as Senate Bill 218, Electronic Co-ops Generation Storage. As there's no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee at this time, we are adjourned at 2:18 p.m.